Okay, so welcome to week two. Excited to be learning with you, with everyone again tonight. It was actually Jackie's suggestion, the sheer topic tonight, which was a great idea. The only hard thing is that the topic we're going to talk about, I'm just going to mention the first things that came to my mind. Then in the weeks since he mentioned it, I had a bunch of other ideas that we could have focused on. But I think we're going to focus on what is, in my experience working in a hospital, the most common things. So the discussion is for tonight areas in which halacha, or one committed to Jewish law, will have a conflict with American law and American legal and medical practice. And so the first one I wanted to mention is regarding brain death. We're not going to go into the sugya in depth. It wouldn't even do it justice if we spent the whole hour just doing the sugya of brain death. Though I will share with you the primary sources for that. But there's a few important things to talk about before we even talk about brain death. And my goal to share with you in this series is in my experience as a chaplain and someone who works at the hospital. My goal is not to show you all the lumdus and all the marimakomos, but what are some of the real-life practical issues? So a couple of them that you just have to be aware of that are very, very important is, you know, someone could easily ask, you know, why is a rabbi talking about the definition of death? You know, as people have asked me before in the hospital, like, Rabbi, this is not none of your business. We're talking about definition of death. You can provide pastoral care, and you can be supportive, and you might have Jewish law, but when it comes to medical issues, defining death, leave it to the doctors. That's a scientific question. So it's very crucial to point out that I actually believe that the definition of death is 1,000% a religious, halachic for a Jew, philosophical, ethical question, and not a medical question at all. The criteria for determining death is 100% medical, but the definition of what renders someone dead, that is philosophical. That is, you know, what point do we consider someone to be no longer alive? It's definition versus criteria. We have to work together. The doctors, once we can explain to someone what our definition of death is, then we can help them to figure out what will be the criteria to determine that definition. But the definition itself is religious. It goes even further, even deeper. I would really say that it not only is the definition of death, the definition of death is religious, and the criteria is scientific, but it's also a difference of state versus status. As we would say in Hebrew, chalos shame. What does it mean? If someone has, let's say we refer frequently to marital status, right? What gives someone marital status? They didn't change. They stood under a chuppah. They put the chassan puts a ring on the kala's finger. There's kosher edim. He says a reak mekudeshesli. And all of a sudden, their status has completely changed, and all kinds of halachos have changed because the status. What happened? She's the same. They're the same exact people. There's status and state. State is a biological state. Right? Biological. And status is a religious conceptual state. And there's a difference between the state and status. So this came there's a whole book about this. Dr. Rabbi Naftali Moses wrote a book called Really Dead. It was his PhD dissertation at Bar-Ilan University. It's a fantastic book. It's the history of brain death in Israel. And in Israel, there's always been tension between the medical establishment and the rabbis. Hebrew University, the medical school there, it was delayed 20 years. It couldn't open for 20 years over one issue. The issue of, were they going to use cadavers to study on in the medical school? The medical school wanted to. The rabbis fought it, and they were fighting and fighting so much until they kind of came up with an agreement about when autopsies would be allowed and what they could study. It took them 20 years. And then it turned out that they didn't really keep their promise, and there was massive protests all around Israel and lots of fights between the rabbis and the medical establishment. So when organ donation became a possibility, that's when brain death, I mean, that's the reality. Brain death is a reaction to organ donation. Because the way it works medically, I mean, we have doctors here, you can just correct me if I'm wrong, but this one point, I'm not going to go into medicine, but there's one point you have to know that when I figured this out, it like made me all of a sudden understand this whole topic. Basically, and again, you'll correct me, but basically, if you think, imagine three points in a human body that are essential. The brain, the heart, and the lungs. Right? Those are pretty important, right? They always fight at Cedars. You know, if you look in the new building at Cedars, the neurology floor is on the fifth floor, and the cardiac floor is on the third floor. And everyone wanted the fifth floor because it's a much better view. And they were fighting, and they were saying, well, no, the brain's more important, no, the heart's more important, the brain's more important, they were going back and forth. Finally, the neurologist won because they said, okay, fine, they're both important, but look at a human body, brain's on top, so we'd go on top. And they couldn't come back to that, and so the neurology got to be on the fifth floor. So let's imagine you have your brain, your heart, and your lungs, all important. But they don't all, they work in tandem, but they don't control each other. Your brain does not control your heart. A heart is possible, theoretically, to beat on its own. They even have that. They might have seen this recently. There's a YouTube about a heart in Australia that they were able to keep it beating because they're trying to make heart transplants, you know, better. They had a heart in a tub by itself beating. So technically, a heart can beat. It has its own internal pacemaker mechanism. A heart can beat on its own without the brain telling it. But the brain controls your breathing, right? You don't have to think to breathe. Your brain tells you when to breathe, and then your breathing keeps your heart alive. If you don't have oxygenated air, your heart will stop. So it's a process. But the brain, it's the brain to the lungs to the heart. So it used to be in the past, if someone's brain would be damaged horribly, then the brain stops working, the lungs stop, the heart stops, everything stops. But to get organ donation, you have to have perfused, you know, the organs have to be perfused so they don't die. They have to have oxygenated blood in them. So what happens when you want someone's organs? So you can't kill someone. We have an American law too, dead donor rule. You can't kill for someone's organs. You want the organs though. So when someone is dying, if they're intubated, they have a tube breathing for them. So now the brain doesn't have to tell them to breathe. The machine can breathe for them, and you have the lungs and the heart still going despite lack of brain function. Right? So then they realize, the doctors realize, so if we don't want to kill people, because that's not going to look good for their organs, so we have to have a new definition of death, because death was always defined as a heartbeat. So they came up with brain death, which I'm not saying it to belittle the definition, say, oh, they just made it up for brain death. They have reasons why they think it makes sense, and without a brain, it's not much. You know, I mean, a lot of my kids think I'm brain dead. No, but no, I mean, it's not. It is. You are pretty compromised without a brain. But they came up with this definition to make heart transplantation work. So when the Israeli medical establishment realized we want to also be involved with heart donation, heart transplantation, and also other organs, vital organs, we need brain death here. So they realized, you know what? We've had too many fights with the rabbis. The only way, they're being strategic, the only way we're going to be able to get brain death accepted in Israel as if the rabbis are on board. If the rabbis accept it, so let's go to the rabbis first, let's get their sign off, and then we go out to the public and say, look, organ donation can happen in Israel. They went to the rabbis first, they got a lot of pushback, they kept on going back and forth. Finally, eventually, the rabbanut paskened that they accepted brain death based on a psak of Rav Moshe. We're going to look at it in a second. That psak of Rav Moshe is very, very, very controversial. It's not clear that Rav Moshe meant what the way they read it, but either way, the chief rabbanut with great gedolim on their panel did accept brain death. All at the day their psak came out, all the major gedolim in Israel wrote tshuvas, publicized tshuvas against it. I'm forgetting the year, but we're talking about early 1980s, like 1981, something like that. I don't remember the exact date. Ramosha was alive, but he was at the point, if I'm not mistaken, he was at the point where they were not able to clarify with him. So when did he die? When did 86? So it's in that ballpark because they were not able to clarify with him. They were going on testimony. That's part of their psak, is that they said we have testimony from someone. One of their in their psak they wrote from someone who spoke to him about him, and he, so they weren't able to ask him. So maybe it's closer than to 86, 87. It's in the 80s, but so. Part of their psak, they realized, you know what? The medical establishment might abuse this, and this is a chalos shame. This is a halachic status. We have to say, the rabbis say when someone's dead, not the doctors. So they said, we are going to accept brain death. We're going to see what they base on in a second. But they have a whole bunch of criteria. One of their criteria was, every time brain death is declared in Israel, a rabbi has to review it and sign off. Without a rabbi's approval, they cannot declare brain death. So Hadassah, it was again Hadassah, got their psak. They were very excited. They got the psak they wanted. And then they started doing this, and they weren't calling the rabbis. And the rabbanut said, wait, you're not following our protocol. They said, that's ridiculous. We're not going to call rabbis for brain death. We're the doctors. And they said, no. This is what we need it. We need rabbis to be involved. They said, well, you're not going to be involved. So the rabbanut said, fine, we withdraw our psak. So the Hadassah said, too late. It's out there. You're going to look like you're going to withdraw your psak. We take it already, and we're going with it. And they did withdraw the Pesach. Eventually they put it back. The point was, everyone was trying to analyze. This Rabbi Moses analyzes in this book. What happened? They were working together and it broke down. It was a state versus status. The medical establishment said, no, we only need a medical status. The rabbi said, no, it's a religious state. Chalos shame. And that was where the breakdown was. I'll give you an example. One time, we had a patient dying in our neuro ICU. So she was brain dead, and her son was a very devoted son. He was by her side at all times, and he was talking to me about, you know, he says it's very complicated because I understand that according to the state of California, according to the doctors, they see her as being dead. But my obligation as a son right now is kibud aim. She's my mother. She's alive according to us, and it's not yet my focus is not yet on kvura. You can't start planning a funeral when someone's alive. So he says, but it was the status. He says, once the status changes, I'm going to immediately switch to preparing your funeral. So the doctors wanted to talk to him because they're frustrated. You know, they think he doesn't get it. She's dead. So we had a little meeting. And he asked an innocent question, something like, you know, can you please just describe my mother's condition and what's going to happen? And the doctor's thinking like, what's the matter with him? Doesn't he realize she's dead? He did, but not according to Jewish law. He wants to know, like, when is that going to happen so he can prepare himself? And so one of the doctors there was a resident who was like fed up with him. And she says, what do you mean, how's she doing? She's dead. D-E-A-D. She is dead. She was like trying to drive, and he starts crying, of course. It was horrible. And I had to explain to her, no, you don't understand. To us, she is not dead. So, you know, please calm down and take a step back. We're talking about two different things. We recognize how serious this is. But to us, this is not yet death. We know that she's not going to walk out of this hospital. No, when someone's really brain dead, they don't recover from that if they're truly brain dead. But anyways, that is the background. Okay? So the background, just to summarize real quick what I just said. Brain death, definition of death means something different when you're talking to a religious person versus most other people. In general, when someone talks about death, if you're a religious person, you're talking about what is the... Here, get your sheet. We're talking about what is the definition of death is what does it mean? What's the philosophical meaning of life and death? And then a doctor, their job is the criteria. Definition versus criteria. And a religious person is talking about the state someone's in, whereas the medical team is talking about the status. And once we understand those definitions and those roles, it can help us to move forward appropriately. So let's now take a look at some sources. And now with that background, hopefully we can understand a little bit better the debate around brain death. And then I want to share with you a couple of anecdotes about where this comes up. And that will lead directly into the issue of organ donation and some challenges there. And my goal is to finish earlier tonight and then share with you one other issue and then have some discussion as well. So here's the issue. Again, brain death, there's some great books. There's a great book put out by Shari Tzedek called Kviat Rega HaMaves. It's a very thick book. Even in the introduction of that book, it says, this book is not enough to cover the topic. It's just an introduction. It's a whole thick book. You know, there's great books, and whole books are not enough to cover this topic. So Achas Kama V'Kama, four sources are not going to cover the topic. But what I do want to share with you is, you know, it took me a long time to understand the issue of brain death and what's considered death in Judaism. And the way for me to understand it was by simplifying it. So I'm going to give you a simplified version that will hopefully at least help you appreciate it. But I just want you to recognize that there's so much more to talk about. But here's the basic two sides of the issue with brain death, okay? It mostly comes down to one Gemara in Yuma. I think we mentioned this Gemara last week. Yes, we did. So here's the Gemara. The Gemara is talking about a wall that collapses on Shabbos. Can you dig through the wall, assuming that is Chilul Shabbos, digging through the rubble to save life? Can you save life? So obviously you can, right? Because we say, B'kuach nefesh in hochinach harov. We always do everything we can. But if you knew someone was dead, even though we have a concept of kvura, and we want to have kavod ames, we would not be mechallel Shabbos to take out. We wouldn't violate Shabbos to take out a corpse. So we want to know, until what time is the person considered alive? So here's the Gemara. Here's the main Gemara. Tana Rabbanan. Ad heichan hu bodik. Where do you check to? What if you just find an arm? You know, I mean, the whole body's there, but you only found part of the body. Do you keep digging? We're trying to do as little chilul Shabbos, as little breaking of Shabbos as possible. Where do you check? Ad chotmo. Tanakama, first opinion is, until the nose. You got to find the nose for obvious reasons, checking for respiration. V'yeshomrim, but there's a yeshomrim ad libo, until the heart. By the way, the Yerushalmi and a number of Rishonim have a girsa that it's ad tiburo, just so you know. Ad tiburo means the belly, right? Navel. So, but this opinion is, and this is the Gemara that we have, ad libo. That seems to be that it's looking for a heartbeat, right? Ad libo. So it's either looking for respiration or circulation. The Gemara continues. Badak umatz elyoni mesim. What if you start looking? You do find dead bodies on top, but you know there's more below. Lo yomar kvar meso atachsonim. Oh, the bottom ones must be dead too. No, you keep looking. And even there is a maisa shahaya. Umatzau elyoni mesim v'tachtonim chayim. The ones on top were dead, but beneath them they were alive. So we know you keep looking. Okay, next point. Nema hanitanai kehanitanai. So this is a debate. Is it to the nose or to the heart? And there's another debate that's similar. And always when we talk about death, we talk about life. If I'm going to tell you that that death is a definition of death, how we define death, it's all going to be based on how do we define life? When are you alive? What constitutes life? So there's a debate about where a vlad is formed from, right? Where the fetus is formed from, right? One opinion is mirosho. It starts from the head, and then the body comes out. You know, the neck, and then the whole body comes out from the head. But the head comes first. That's first opinion, right? Shenemar mimei imi atagozi. There's a pasuk of Tehillim. You have taken me out from my mother from the womb, right? But it's atagozi. You've pulled me out. But then we have another pasuk, gazi nizrech v'hishlichi. You've pulled out my hair, and you pulled me by my hair. But it seems to be Gazi here and Gazi there seems to both be head. So that's how we get that opinion. Abba Shaul Omer, the other opinion is Mitiburo, from the navel. You see how this could fit with another girsa of Tibur, but either way, even if it's heart. Tiburo, from the navel. Umishlach Sharshav Elech Elech. And then a baby starts with its belly, and then the legs come out from the bottom, the arms from the side, and the head from the top. That's how a baby is formed, from the middle. He doesn't bring a pasuk, this opinion, Abba Shaul. Just Svara. So a filo tema Abba Shaul, even if you agree with Abba Shaul that it starts from the navel, that the main thing where a baby is created is from their belly or from their heart, that's parallel to the heart. Ad kan lo ka amar Abba Shaul hasam. There he's not talking about in yitzira, where you're created from. The chomide mi mitzise mitzar. Everything's created from its middle. Aval in yipikuach nefesh, but when it comes to saving a life, and this is here we now have the definition of death, or of life. Everyone agrees that the ikra chiyusa, the main point of life in a person is ba'ape, in their nose. In their nose. Dixiv kol asher nishmas ruach chayim ba'apav. We have in Brachos everything that has life in its nose. Right? Amar of Papa, machlokas miatan lamala. Anyways, it's only a machlokas if you found the person from the bottom of al mimala lamata. But if you find the person from the top, kiven the buttock layat chodma. Once you check the nose, shuv eno tzarich. Then it's no machlokas. That's enough. Tekseiv kosher and nishas ruachaim ba'afav. And the Shulchan Aruch there paskins like that opinion that the main thing to know someone's alive is if they are breathing. So how do we paskin? What is the definition of death or of life? If it's breathing, how do we know if you're alive or dead? Breathing. Now, if I said that in America, the debate is either it's neurological criteria, brain function, or it's cardiopulmonary criteria, working heart. So how does this inform that? We now know that the definition of death is the ability to breathe. So there's two ways to go with this. First one is Rashi, at least the way the Chacham Tzvi reads Rashi. So let's look at some Rashis here. And then we'll see the explanation of Rashi, and then you'll have basically, you'll be able to see the two sides of the debate. First of all, Rashi says, when it's asked, ad hechenu bodek, how far do you check? If the person is doma lemes, she'enu mezi zevarav, that they're not moving, then where do you check? So by the way, that point right there, which is not the point we're going to focus on, the Chacham Sofer picks up on, it says, oh, part of the definition of death is you're not moving. Enu mezi zevarav. It's no spontaneous movement. Lack of vital function is the way they call it. So interesting, I'll just tell you a quick anecdote. Some poskim go with that as part of the definition. There can't be any vital motion. If the body is working, person's alive. So we had a case. Listen to this case. This is relevant for what we're talking about. We had a case where there was a patient. We now have at Cedars artificial hearts. Patients have artificial hearts. Well, not today. There was, and then there was a big controversy with them. So there's not that many right now. But there have been a lot of artificial hearts. We had a patient who came for a heart transplant, but was not was too sick for a heart transplant, so they needed to put an artificial heart to get him better, to take him to the time where he could get a heart transplant. Now he has a machine in his chest pumping his blood. So they take out one's heart to put in an artificial heart. Then he deteriorated, and he wasn't able to breathe. So now he's on a respirator. Then his lungs weren't working. So he was on CRT, continuous dialysis. His blood pressure, well, you know, they needed pressors. He wasn't able to eat anything, so he had a peg, you know, for artificial nutrition. So now you have a person there who has a machine pumping his blood, a machine breathing for him, a machine cleansing his blood for his kidneys, a machine feeding him, it was all based on machines because his body was deteriorating. In fact, his limbs were beginning to shrivel. He was like a corpse. He happened to be paying cash, like $1 million a week or something like crazy number. And they were, for a little while, letting it go. I asked local rabbi in town, what do you think about this? He was like, this is a hard question, but all I know is you can send him to my shul if you need to. We'll make room for him. And I'm joking. I'm joking. I mean, he did say that, but he said it as a joke. So I sent the shout out to different posting. And I got responses from Rav Asher Weiss, Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein in Bnei Brak, and Rabbi J. David Bleich in New York. The question was, at what point is this person dead? Because if we say it's either brain death or heart, I mean, he doesn't even have a heart. And the person is literally shriveling up. It was like, is this... No, totally unconscious, but not brain dead. Yes, the breathing tube was breathing for him. It's pumping the breaths. But yes. If you would take it off, he would die.
Would he try to breathe, but he wouldn't be able to
move
his lungs?
Maybe minimal, but...
So his brain did have some activity. It was trying to...
He wasn't brain dead. The problem is there are different parts of the brain, so brain dead, which we're going to talk about in a second. But maybe his brain would have tried to initiate minor breaths. It would have lasted for a couple of minutes. He would have been dead very quickly. But he wasn't brain dead. That's the point. That's why it was a challenge. Because if he was brain dead, you'd say, okay, at least according to the post, going to say brain death. He was dead according to them. So I'll come back to the other ones maybe, but Rabbi Bleich, who tends to be somewhat, you know, more on the, I don't want to say extreme because it's not nice, but he is seen as more on the furthest end of the spectrum in terms of being very strong proponent of only heartbeat and only vital motion. So he said to me, as long as he has even peristaltic function of his small intestines, which means peristalsis is like when the muscles like contract just to push things through them, if there's any movement in his body that's autonomous, even in his small intestines, he's alive. So he said. Well, that's so not everyone agrees with that. Exactly, but that's the way Rabbi Bleich understands that line. Based on the Chassam Sofer, it seems to read it that way too, but it's a big debate in how Chassam Sofer reads it. But, well, because that's Rashi. That's the way Rashi reads it. So I'm just giving you an example of how far that you could take that Rashi. Let's go on a little bit, because I can't believe it already came 8:24. How did that happen? So then, ad chotmo, according to the opinion, you have to check for the nose. So here's the main line. Sorry, did you not get a sheet here? There, right here. So here's the main line. On the bottom there, it says, why are you checking in the heart and why checking in the nose? Belibo yesh lehavchin. In the heart, you can check, you can feel. Im yesh bo chiyus, if they're alive. Shenishmaso dofekesham. Okay, this right there, that line also, is books on that. Is it nishmaso or nishimato? Because the way their science was, they believed that the heart was a respirator and it was actually part of the respiratory system. So some believe that Rashi meant shenishimato. But we're going to read it, shenishimato dofekesham. V'mar amar adchotmo, why adchotmo? Tezimnin de'enchius nikar belibo. In other words, the lave is the main thing, but you can't always feel it because you have ribs and muscle on top, or fat, whatever. For me, it's muscle. No, I'm joking. On top of your heart. And you can't feel the heart so well, right? So it has to be ad chotmo, dezimnin de'enchius nikar belibo, v'nikar bechotmo. But in the nose, you can feel if there's some breathing. And since, until respirators, the whole system was connected, so you would check through the nose. And that would be enough. But what you care about is the heart. Right? So to Rashi, if we go back to my discussion before of criteria, definition criteria, The heart is not the, the nose, even though the Gemara said it, we care about the nose, but the nose is not the definition of death, to Rashi. It's the criteria. It's the test, right? The definition is the heart. The Chacham Seed explains this in better detail, but we don't need to read it inside, but that's what he says there. On the other hand, though, here's the whole debate. See, this is how you could just wrap it up simply. I'm warning you, it's much more complicated than this, but this is how you make it very simple. Rashi says, we care about the nose. Why? It's the test for the heart. The brain death proponents argue, we care about the breathing. What controls the breathing? It's in the brain. The brain is what controls our breathing, as I explained to you before. So if one's not able to breathe, then that means then they're dead, because they're not. So if their brain has stopped functioning, even though you have a tube in their throat forcing them to breathe, they're not alive anymore because they can't breathe on their own. That's the debate. It's more complicated than that. There's also a Mishan Olos about tuma starts from an animal if it's hutaz rosho, if its head's cut off. And so there's a concept of physiological decapitation that Rabbi Tendler coined that phrase, that once someone has no head, then they're dead. But this is a whole debate, and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach seems to accept that argument, but he argues it has to be complete decapitation, meaning there can't be any cellular function. We had at Cedars a while back, there's a prominent neurologist at UCLA who, most secular medical ethicists, doctors, accept brain death. I mean, that's the standard. But there's a prominent secular fellow, who does not accept brain death. He thinks that it's a farce. So he gave a lecture at Cedars. And it was very controversial and exciting. And there was a luncheon afterwards. And one of the neurologists at Cedars was arguing with him, and they're going back and forth. And it was fascinating, this point that a neurologist made. He said, give me a break. He said, look, we all know. He said, I declare death all the time. But I know full well that the patients are still alive. What did he mean? Not that they're going to get out and walk out. He says, what I mean is some of their body is still alive, meaning there's still cellular reproduction. I know that when they're put in the grave, their nails might grow a little bit, or their hair might grow. There's still some parts of their bodies that are... But at a certain point, you have to say, okay, death is a process. At a certain point, you say, this person is no longer alive. And this doctor was arguing, give me a break. Someone doesn't have a brain function, they're not alive. The other doctor was responding, like, we define a person sometimes beyond just their ability to have coherent thoughts, right? So I just found that it to be a fascinating debate to think about it, the fact that there is death as a process. But this is the debate. Now, yeah. What?
Is that also the concept too, the death of the process, and we're just trying to define
it? Yeah, the Rambam uses the phrase talich hamavas. It's talich hamavas. The only thing is that death as a process, in the old days, the Rambam says, for example, when someone dies, you know you can't touch a ghost. So he says, you have to wait about 20 minutes. Why? Because maybe there's still a ghost face for 20 minutes, you don't know, so leave him alone. But now, so there was this concept of, you know, a half hour or so where the person is dying. But nowadays, I mean, someone could be in the dying process for a very long time, because mechanically, artificially, we keep that process going. So, you know, it was just that process has been extended. But death is a process. So so let me give you another anecdote to explain what we do with this, and then I'll give you a first real challenging question. So what do we do with brain death? That's the first issue. Most post-game, the majority, clearly, by far, is does not accept brain death. The majority of accepted post-game today argue that if there's cardiopulmonary function, if a person's heart's beating, they are alive. The soul is still there, and they are alive. So we keep... What? Even though it's mechanically aided, yes. But it's there. The heart's beating, and they're still alive. And they would argue that's still a life. And you still have to, you know. So what do we do, though? Because we live in a society where brain death is accepted as a definition of death. What do? We have this all the time at Cedars, and we have it all around the country. But that's my only experience is at Cedars. So we have a policy at Cedars, but it's based on a state law that exists to different extents in different states. New Jersey has the most aggressive. New York has one, mostly thanks to Gudas Israel and their advocacy. And California has a strong one as well. And Cedars has an expansive one. It's called the reasonable accommodation policy, where we try to get the state and the hospitals to reasonably accommodate. If someone is dead, according to the state, but according to us, they're still alive. So we ask for them to give them an accommodation, which usually means 2 or 3 days where they just let it be. And the idea behind that, part of the idea is, if you let it be, if someone's really brain dead, they will die on their own. Their body will stop. Their heart will stop functioning soon enough. So let it happen naturally. Part of the problem, by the way, is that there's no uniform criteria. There's just a controversy in the neurological world there's no uniform criteria for determining brain death. The chief rabbinate, they do have a criteria. And theirs is a strict criteria. And many people who are declared brain dead, this is important, for even those posthumously accept brain death, there's many patients who are declared brain dead who are not brain dead according to halachic standards of brain death. And even brain death, I mean, it's something that we don't take lightly. Dr. Steinberg told me when he was here last that one time he had a case with a Sephardi. Most of the Sephardi Gedolim, Rav Avadya Yosef, they did accept brain death very reluctantly and very within very certain parameters, but they did accept it. And he told me of a case they had where in Shari Tzedek where they wanted to declare someone brain dead, so they called Rav Amar. He was the Rav Rashi at the time. And he said, okay, everything you're describing to me sounds like we could accept this, but I'm not going to paskin unless we get a Beis Din together. And the whole Beis Din accepts it. And they got together a Beis Din, and the Beis Din paskin, and Rabbi Dr. Steinberg told me that Rav Amar said to him, first of all, I don't want it just to be on my shoulders. Let's share. We're sharing the punishments, so to speak. The Gemara has such a concept sometimes where in case we're wrong, we share it. We're sharing the responsibility. But they take it that seriously. Like, this is a big deal, right? It's literally life and death. So anyway, so we have reasonable accommodation. We try to accommodate. But it gets tricky. So we have someone in a hospital bed who the staff now thinks is dead. They are, like, in some ways, a corpse. In other ways, though, you look at them, they look like someone who's sleeping. They look, their skin, I mean, that's part of the challenge with brain death. Their body is functioning in many ways. They're still digesting food if they are receiving artificial nutrition. They're still maintaining homeostasis. They keep their body temperature. Their body is still alive, but it's mechanically supported. So it's difficult for the family, difficult for the staff. In our ICU, for example, in our neuro ICU, we had tried to have a policy where we would have people be allowed to stay over on Shabbos and Yom Tov. So at first, the idea of the hospital said to me, well, they can stay, but they have to pay for their room, and we won't kick them out on Shabbos. So I said, okay, how much does a room cost? They said, they sent me the bill, sent me the thing. So a regular room at Cedars, I mean, you won't pay this if you go there because insurance helps. A regular room is about $5,000 a night. An ICU room in the neuro ICU for one night, $40,000. So sometimes the staff gets a little bit, worked up. And it's a complicated, ICU. And they have a patient there that they believe is dead. There's a corpse. And we've had many stories like this, but we once had a patient who was brain dead. And we were invoking our reasonable accommodation policy. And the ICU filled up, totally full. And then I get a call from the manager of the ICU. We have a patient in the emergency room who is in a head trauma. And they need to come to our ICU. But our ICU is full. We need to save this person's life. Oh, but we have one room that's being occupied right now by what we think is a corpse. So we need to figure something out quick, Rabbi, because you are preventing someone's life from being saved right now. So that's a pretty difficult question. So first I asked the Shaila, and I called, first of all, I said, are we allowed to save a life? Can we sacrifice a brain-dead patient? Even if we're not passing, we're not accepting brain death, but at least it's maybe a ghost. Can we... So the psak I got was, exactly. Ad kadei kach ein dochin nefesh mi bein nefesh. The person is, they may be brain dead, but they are alive. We don't sacrifice one life for the other. And the truth is, I did not feel embarrassed to say that to the staff, because I feel pride in that in a certain way. I see why they think it's ridiculous, but our religion stands up very firmly for the rights of those who are otherwise oppressed. I mean, we could say it in modern terms, like, hey, look, we stand up for the oppressed. What's the oppressed? A brain dead. Everyone. In other words, my point is, no matter how compromised someone is, no matter what their mental status is, no matter, we say, you know what, we don't put one life over the other. Right, but if there's dead.
Right, but what I mean,
right.
Your position is just because you.
Right, exactly. Exactly. That was the argument.
Alive, so
right. So then I went to our medical director, our chief medical officer, who happens to be an Orthodox Jew. And I said, okay, so I got this psak. I'm fighting for this patient to stay there. Now the rabbi's saying we have to. The nurses are fighting me, but you're the medical director. And you understand, I asked the rabbi, you're an Orthodox Jew, what do you say? He said, look, we can't run a hospital. I'm running this hospital, though. This is not an Orthodox hospital. He says, we're going to have to figure something out quick because I can't have brain-dead patients preventing dying patients who need the bed. So I said, okay, let me figure out what to do. So I called a few people for advice, and my advice that I was given was, maybe this was bad, stall. Stall. If you can stall a little bit, it might see if it can resolve itself, see if something can be figured out. So I went to the nurses, and I said, to the nurse manager, I said, there's got to be another bed for that other patient. And she says, only one unit that can accept him, and that patient's also, that unit's also full. So I said, can I go check? She said, okay, fine, go check. So I took my time in checking. I think I got lunch first. I mean, it sounds bad, but it was intentional because I was trying to give it some time to something things figure out, and kahavi. When I came back, I went back there and I said, okay, you know what? We have to figure something out, but you're right. There's no beds. This is now like 3 hours later. And she says, oh, no, we found another bed, another ICU bed for that patient in the emergency room. It's going to work out. It's okay. For now, Rabbi, it's okay. So it worked out. So stalling actually worked. The truth is, we had another patient like that who we transferred that brain dead patient, and we're trying to prevent it again because we don't want to move brain dead patients because they're at least a GOSES. And you know that bridge between Saperstein and the medical main building at the hospital? And literally going over the bumps into the bridge, the patient died. So you see sometimes, you know, how delicate it is. But and sometimes the doctors can say, you know, you give it accommodation, and at a certain point they just say, okay, unilaterally, we're withdrawing. And then your only choices are go to another facility, but good luck finding a facility that's going to take a brain dead patient, or a court order. And you can fight it if you have a case. But it's not simple. So here's where now let's start transitioning. So that's brain death. As you see, it's a big challenge. You asked for places where Jewish law and American law, where there's challenges. Brain death is a big one. There's a lot more stories, but I don't know how to tell them without giving away a little bit of information about like who they were, and I'm worried about sharing HIPAA violations, whatever. There's a lot of stories. It's very challenging, brain death, for those who don't accept it. But listen to this. So let's start moving into organ donation. For much organ donation, you need to accept brain death for much organ donation. So let me take a step back. Is organ donation allowed in Judaism? Are we pro-organ donation or not? It's a big challenge, and I'll tell you one reason why. I once had a patient who, I mean, this is a story. Look, I take a more traditional view on this, but the story, I think, needs to be told because it's something we have to struggle with. I was once called up. A nurse called me to help to visit a patient. So I went to visit, and I found a patient totally irresponsive and a woman who was like a very kind of aggressive woman sitting by his bedside, not related to him. So I didn't really figure out why I was called there. I visited them a little bit, and then as I walked out, the nurse saw me. And she says, oh, Rabbi, I called for you. Thank you for coming. So I said, yeah, how can I be helpful? So she says, here's the story. This man collapsed in his house. The ambulance picked him up. He lives alone. His next door neighbor saw the ambulance arriving and saw him being wheeled out and saw that he was in bad shape. She jumps in her car, follows the ambulance to the hospital, and has been staying by his side the whole time. Sounds very devoted, very nice. So finally I try to figure out, you know, who are you? Are you related? She says, no. She says to the nurse, we are Orthodox Jews. And we know what you people do here in hospitals. We know this is an academic hospital, and you're going to do autopsies. I'm here to prevent that. And most of all, I know you guys try to take organs to do organ donation. I'm here to make sure that none of that happens. We're Orthodox Jews. We don't believe in that stuff. So she says to me, this is a very painful moment, what she said to me. She says, so Rabbi, here's my question. I do not think she was anti-Semitic. She was very sincere. She says, so she said it to me, and I see why she's very devoted. It's very beautiful on the one hand. But she says, Rabbi, you know, at this hospital, we're doing so many organ donations. How come so many times when I have Orthodox Jewish patients, they're trying to, like, bribe us and call in a favor to get on the top of the list to get an organ? And now when it comes to receiving an organ, she's, like, telling me, no, we don't give organs. She's, like, fighting. We cannot give an organ. She's like, Rabbi, is that true? You guys won't give organs, but you want to take them? And it was a challenging question. It was a very challenging question. Like, how do we respond to that? Because, yes, there are some times when we can't donate organs. If we don't accept brain death, that's going to preclude a lot of organ donation. But we do accept them. So where do we... So here's the way I deal with this. And I want to share something with an approach that I want to share with you because it is a challenge and it's also a halachic issue. So I believe, you know, all the time, I just taught a class this week to high school students, and I taught about organ donation, and I said, what do you think Judaism says about organ donation? They all said, we know already, Rabbi, it's forbidden. I said, really? Does everyone agree? I said, yeah, we know. We already know it's forbidden. So organ donation is not so pashut. There are some types of organ donation that are absolutely forbidden. And then there are some types of organ donation that are absolutely permitted. And then there's a gray area. We're going to talk about the gray area tonight. But what's forbidden? Okay, it is clear. If you have to kill someone to take an organ, so we don't believe in that. Ein dochi nefesh mipnei nefesh. So much organ donation, you have a patient who is brain dead, and then they're going to take organs, and that's obviously going to kill them the rest of the way, so to speak. That's going to kill them. So we can't do that. And there's another case, which I'm going to explain in a second. If someone's a cadaver, if someone's already died, of course there are many less organs that they can donate at that time, but tissues, organ tissue, you know, tissue, corneas, there are things. There are halakhic issues there with, you know, you have to bury, and you can't get hana from the dead, and you can't have nivel hames. But the poskim have dealt with those and concluded, you know, either we say that that part of the body comes back to life, so to speak, or it's for pikuach nefesh. Whatever it is, we do allow organ transplantation from a corpse. From someone who's alive, we're going to talk about that in a second. Let's talk about the middle area in a sec, for right now, the gray area. We have the dead donor rule in America. You can't kill someone, take their organs, but if they're brain dead, you could take. What about DCD? One of the most common ways that we get organs is donation after cardiac death, DCD. How does it work? It goes as follows. You tell me what you think about this. You tell me what you think. Here's how DCD works. Patient's not brain dead. If they're brain dead, it's no problem. They're brain dead, you just keep them ventilated and start cutting. But they're not brain dead. American law has the dead donor rule. You cannot kill someone for their organs, for obvious ethical reasons, out of concern that doctors are going to really want the organs, and they're going to kill for them. So DCD works as follows. You have a patient who you feel, you know, this patient is so compromised, they're not going to come back. They're not brain dead, but they are too injured, too compromised to ever recover. They are a dying patient. So let's prep them for surgery. They're still alive. Brain's functioning, heart's functioning. Let's bring them to the operating room now. Prep them for surgery. They're alive. Prep them for surgery. Insert a catheter where you're giving all kinds of medications to encourage blood flow and to make the organs last. What's the word? Right, I'm not coming up with the word. What? Perfuse organs, but also preserve. Thank you. It's a simple word. Preserve the organs, and they're prepping the body. While the patient's alive, the patient's brain is working. They prep the body, they're ready for surgery, and then they withdraw everything. With the surgical team ready to go, they withdraw, and they wait. And they wait, and as soon as the person dies, you have to wait a little bit longer because there's a possibility of auto-resuscitation. Sometimes, I once had a patient, a few times now, where I've been called to patients. I'm a chaplain, right? Patient dead, everyone's crying, we're gathered around, we're praying. Then we escort, we go out to another room, we sit down, we talk about the funeral, we're praying. And the nurse comes back, Rabbi, can I talk to you for a second? That patient who you're planning their funeral for that died and that you prayed for, he's alive. He's alive, he's not dead anymore. And that happens. Because sometimes you think they're dead, especially when they're not on monitors. So you think, okay, nope, there's no more heartbeat, they're dead. And then the heart starts again. So you have to wait. They have to wait between 90 seconds and 5 minutes. Okay, they wait. They withdrew everything. Okay, no more heartbeat. Okay, start cutting. And they start cutting and taking out and retrieving the organs. That's DCD. That's an accepted common practice. What do you think Halacha is going to say about DCD? Yeah, so this is problematic. What? Yeah, this is a big problem. There is what? Yeah, they withdrew. They withdrew everything. Okay, that's what we talked about last week, though. Well, yeah, on a ghost case, that's also problematic. Someone who's dying, you're supposed to not even take. You're not supposed to take blood. You're supposed to, like, so you're doing interventions on. Yeah, it's a problem. There's another kind of DCD, but what? Exactly, that's why it's a problem. There's two types of DCD, by the way. That's called control. There's one called uncontrolled. Some are trying this. There's a New York protocol. They're doing this in New York now, where they bring with ambulances the technology to, if they find someone in the field meaning outside the hospital, who has collapsed, who's dying, and they declare them dead, but they just died, they can then continue to respirate them and keep them going. They put a pumper like on their heart to keep their blood pumping, and they basically keep their body viable after they've died, and then take them back to the hospital to get the organs. That's actually less problematic. The person's already died. They didn't cause the death. They died. And then they say, you know what? They're dead now. Maybe we can save other lives with them. Okay, that's different. What?
It seems most legitimate.
Yeah. Especially if they already said they wanted to be an organ donor.
That's more of a cover-based issue.
It could be, but those who favor it argue that it's not nivel hames because it's for pikuach nefesh. Nivel HaMes is important, but it doesn't override Pekuach Nefesh. Yeah. Pekuach Nefesh doesn't override killing, right? You can't kill someone for Pekuach Nefesh, but Nivel HaMes. I mean, the post-game do recognizing the fact that it's going to also go to a non-Jew, yes. It's allowed. I mean, because if you, what are you going to check first, and then it's going to like, yeah, I think so. But yeah, I mean, that's l'maisa what we do. So that's the big challenge. That's a big issue, right? We want to donate organs, but we have this gray area. Then there is the area that I think is permissible, I mean, in some cases, and this is my theory, what I think. And the truth is, this has happened recently with Adam Kreef. I can say the name, I mean, because it's so famous, you know. I want to argue, and I'm going to show you some sources here, and we'll discuss it, and then we'll wrap it up in a second, that Jews, especially Orthodox Jews, it's true, we can't donate all organs, and some we can receive. I mean, there are some who argue, if we can't donate them, we shouldn't receive those ones. But most post-game argue for various reasons, which we're not going to go to now, that you could receive, even if you can't donate. So we're stuck. I mean, not stuck. We have our values. We have our values, which say we do not push one life for another life, and for that's an ethical value. So, but I believe in those areas that we can donate organs, we should be leading. We should be leaders in it. Let's say blood donation. It's a simple one, right? So let's look at this. Let's just look at the sources for a second. Let me show you. Turn to page 2. Here's what it all comes down to. This is going to be an issue with organ donor cards. Can you carry an organ donor card? We'll talk about that in a second. It all comes down to a shaila that the Radvaz was asked. Radvaz was asked some great shailas. If you look, you know, Radvaz has the shaila about like Yom Kippur, the famous Yom Kippur shaila. If a person is in prison and they're going to get one day to leave the prison, what day do they leave? Oh, maybe they should leave on Rosh Hashanah to hear the shofar. He said, no, go tomorrow. Daven with, you know, go the first chance. Fast on Tzom Gedaliah or Yom Kippur, fast on Tzom Gedaliah, you know. So anyways, he was asked the following shaila. Imagine the shaila. A Jew is shopping in the Shuk. They live in a Muslim land. He lived in Egypt. They live in a Muslim land. The Jew is shopping, and the Jew steals or is accused of stealing from one of the vendors. And he runs. And someone sees him and says, catch that Jew! He wigwags through the place. He gets out alive. He made it. Home free, you know, right? Well, not so simple. The Jews all live in one neighborhood. So the Sultan comes. They surround the Jewish neighborhood. And they say, okay, Jews, we know you people. You're all friends. You all know each other. You're all one community. One of you stole, and the punishment for stealing is off with your hand. So please send forward the person who stole. If not, let's just grab this person at random. Okay, we just got a Jew. We're taking him captive. If you don't come forward, whoever you are, and let us cut off your hand, we're killing this other Jew. Do you have to give your hand for their life? My hand, your life. The questioner asks, interesting, the questioner himself has a, what? For you don't have to give an eight. Right. So the questioner says, Pekuach Nefesh on Shabbos is not Nidchem Yipnei and Aver. So Kanas Aver is not Doche Shabbos, technically. Life is, but not an Aver. So he has this hierarchy that that if Shabbos is, even comes above a limb, so certainly you should be, you know, he thinks, I think you should, obviously you should, it's not such a big, you should be able to give your hand for this person's life. That's what the questioner asked. The Radvaz answers no. His conclusion, I didn't put the whole tshuva, it's a very long tshuva, here number 5 on page 2, he says, actually a very interesting line he says here, it says a side point, it's a fascinating line, V'su d'ktsiv, darcheya darchei noam, its ways are peace and pleasantness, the Torah, v'tzarech shemishpatei Torah sinu, you maskimim el haseichel, the Torah has to be logical, v'asvara, how can we say someone has to blind himself or cut off his hand or raglor his leg in order to save someone else's life? I disagree. It would be a midas chasidus. It would be pious to give your hand for someone else's life, but not obligatory. And if you might die as a result, not only is it not obligatory, it would actually be forbidden. You would be a pious fool. Because if you might die, you cannot give your suffix sakana, your suffix danger for someone else's life. So you're not allowed to put yourself into suffix sakana, suffix danger, potential danger, to save someone else's life. And I got to assume that in those days, chopping off a hand was not so clean and simple. I mean, it was probably a lot of bleeding and pain and all kinds of mess and infections and who knows what, right? So And he goes on in the next tshuva to basically say that the way where we draw the line is safek muhra. Once you get 50-50, once the odds are more than 50% that you could die as a result, you may not put yourself in such danger. Beneath 50%, it's a midas chasidus, but not obligatory. So this ends up becoming the whole debate over over organ donation, live organ donation. A kidney, right? Kidney donation, for example. Can I donate a kidney? So I put here Ravaja's tshuva on it. You're not going to read it inside, but in his summary, he basically shows, and you can see how in the 60s and 70s, the post-game were saying, you can't. Not only can't do, it's usser to donate an organ. Why? Because there's a good chance you're going to die as a result. And then as time went on, the post-game became more okay with it, until Ravaja in the 1980s wrote, it's a mitzvah to donate a kidney. So how does that happen? Did halacha change? It was usher in the 70s, and it's a mitzvah in the 80s? Exactly. Medicine changed. The mitzvah changed. Halacha didn't change, but it's applying itself to a different reality. When you're asked a question, and the question is, I'm going to put my life in danger to save someone else's life, the poskim said, no. But once the doctor said, no, it's not so dangerous anymore. Then the rabbi said, okay, I can't obligate you to, as the Red Vaz said, you're not obligated to, but it would be pious for you to do it. It's kind of like, there's an interesting corollary, just as a side point. Rav Sternbach recently just came out with his seventh volume of tshuvas. So he has a tshuva in there about IVF, in vitro fertilization. In his first sefer of tshuvas, Chelek Aleph, he wrote that it's an isser muchlat for IVF, in vitro fertilization. Totally awesome. But in his second volume, he says it's better not to. In his third volume, he says you could, but I advise against it. In his fourth volume, he says it might be good. In his most recent volume, he says it's a chiyuv. You have to if that's your only way of having children. What happens? He explains himself. He says when the technology was new, we didn't know if it's going to actually work in the long term, how it's going to work, you know, if the children will be healthy. You know, we were concerned about it, lab mistakes. And as it got safer and we became convinced that it's safe and that it works, then we could do it. The point is, the mitzvah changed. So that's what happened with organ donation. You get so far, take a look at the most recent, if you turn the page twice, we'll come back to my little charts there. If you go, and I'm sorry, I put numbers on the bottom, but my number got, you can see a little 4. Looks like 11 at the bottom. It's Shas and Tshuva's Minchas Asher. This is the most recent one. It just came out like 3 months ago. So what about Meach Etzem? Bone marrow, right? This is why I mentioned Adam Kreef before, right? We have someone in our community who's trying to have his life saved. He needs a bone marrow transplant. They just did in Israel, in one day, a drive. They got 30,000 people signed up to be tested to be a bone marrow donor. It's rare. You have to have the right match, and it could save someone's life, and it's not a dangerous procedure. It's a little bit painful. I mean, I'm not saying I don't know, but from what I understand, it's a little bit painful, but there's not real risk involved. But you could save someone's life. So look at what Rav Asher writes. You see where I put the arrow there? He says, Meshum Kainir, he goes through the whole sugya that I just took you through with the Radvaz, and he says, the Kasher Medubar Betrumas Meach Etzem, donating bone marrow, Shehasakana Letorim Hi Kimat Efasit, it's almost negligible, it's almost nothing. Af Im Naniach Shesh Betrumas Zusakana Rechoko, even if you say there's a little bit of a danger, Chiyuv Gamur Hu. If you are a match for someone, it's in Chiyuv Gamur to donate bone marrow to save someone's life. You're saving someone's life, right? Benogela trumat klia. What about donating a kidney? That's a much more of an involved, serious surgery, right? He says, look at what he says here. Lule de mistafine michaverai. If it wasn't that I was afraid of my friend, in other words, the other postgame, hayali binote, my heart would lean towards shehayom, today, now that it's so safe, chiyuv gamorhu. It's also, if you could save someone's life, it's an obligation, not just it's a mitzvah. Rabbi Vajra Yosef said it's a mitzvah. If you do it, it's a mitzvah. Rav Asher Weiss is saying, it's almost an obligation to do it. Dechol ha-mecharim mochichim, that all the studies show, shasakana letorim katana me'od u'kimat znicha. It's virtually nothing. Vasiku le-hatzil gedolmion, and you could really save someone. Ach mikol makom, bor de-havi midas chasidus, for sure. So midas chasidus became roi linhog, it's proper to do so, roi le-odid han-hagazu, and we should be encouraging this. So my argument is, we can't, it's true, we can't donate all organs, like this nurse said to me. But I believe that on the one hand, those that we can't donate, we shouldn't be embarrassed. We have an ethical value that we say we don't give one life for another life. We protect all life no matter how compromised that life is. We stand up for the sake of all life and all stages of a human life. But so we can't in those cases. But in those cases when we can donate organs or tissue, that we should be leading, we should be leaders in that. We should, and the truth is that's why Adam Kreef, I mentioned him again, was such a Kiddush Hashem. They had people in the schools and yeshivas all around signing up to donate to him, to help him, to save life. And many of those people, when they were tested to see if they're a match for him, they said, no, you're not a match for him, but you're not in the registry, and guess what? You're a match for this guy in New Mexico. And so the people said, okay, so let me donate to them. I'll save that life. Fine. And they did it. And it was a great Kiddush Hashem. And there's no loss to that. What do we lose by doing that? You save a life. So that's the challenge with organ donation. That's the big issue that we face there. Any comments or... Yeah, I don't remember what I said to Nurse Mouse. So I don't remember. This was a while back. I remember feeling really sad about it. But, because it's not, I don't remember exactly what I said. I said something like, you know, she's a little bit extreme. It's not true that we never donate organs. We can, and she's just trying to defend him and trying to help him. Any comments? Yeah. Right. I think so. I'm trying to remember a specific post on it. I don't have a strong answer for you. I know that that's the practice, and I know that I've seen that that's the psak. But I'm not sure. I can't give you like an in-depth answer on that. But yeah.
At least it's like a compensation we should allow in the base for cases where you know it's gonna go to the Jew. Maybe that's a theme of this, but I think I've heard that.
Yeah.
You know, like at least you tell a nurse that, you know
right.
We can't.
I mean, you are saving a life, and how severe is the isser of nivel hametz? Is it an isser deraisa? I mean, is minias kavura? But you're going to still bury. You're still going to bury the person. It might push it back a day, but you're still going to bury.
It's potentially directly stated, like the Jew who needs a heart.
Right.
And eventually, the sign would say, "Well, we're not going to give it to the Jew if they don't give anything back." So
it would be incredible, Ava, too. Could you imagine? They start saying, "Okay, we're going to donate, but we need to we're going to need evidence of who's receiving and." Once you start, right? Don't donate ever, and then you're losing the chance to then yes save life. Right.
The
Jews receive a lot of organs. Well, there was yes in Israel in the European Union has a donor sharing network that they share throughout the European Union, and Israel is just kicked out of it. And you know, European Union is not known for being the most. Okay, I know they're not so loving of Israel, but they were showing their statistics, and they said, "Look, here's how many organs we send per year to Israel, and here's how many we get, almost none. And here's how many we give." And they said, "We're giving you a 5-year warning. If that number needs to come up, or you're going to have to, we're not going to give you anymore." And the number did not come up, and that's an issue. So now all of a sudden, all those organs, all those people are not being saved, even from donors in Germany or wherever, Scandinavia. Because Israel wasn't keeping up its fair share.
Might be a big difference in Europe and in
America. Right, could be. But so it's 9:00 now. Should I end it now, or should I do my last? Or should we give 3 minutes of a last topic, or should we just? Okay, fine. Let me just give you the last little spiel. If you want to step out, I won't be offended at all. A little offended. I'm joking. Okay, the last issue that I just wanted to mention. I'll do it just a quick summary, because there's one other issue that's a big challenge when we talk about American law, American practice, medical practice, and Jewish law, and that is physician-assisted suicide. It's now legal in California, physician aid in dying. It's legal in California, physician-assisted suicide. The way it works is that a patient who has a six-month prognosis, 6 months left to live, they are allowed to request aid in dying drugs. The doctor prescribes it to them, tells them how to do it. Then they have to take it themselves. They go home, they get the drugs, they take the drugs, and they die. And that's legal in California, Oregon, Washington, and I think Vermont. And that's it. But it's spreading. And it's legal now. What do we do? What do we do about this? It's very clearly forbidden by Jewish law. I mean, it's not just withdrawing. This is actively killing. This is suicide, intentional suicide, right? And there's a lot of questions involved, which we can't get into now. Can a doctor tell someone about it? Can a person be involved in the process at all?
Physician's prescribing.
The patient themselves is doing it. Right.
That is slightly different than physician assistant.
Right. Can I sell somebody a gun and a copy and they're going to pull their brains out?
Right. Right. Well, can I sell them a gun and tell them exactly what to do to make sure it works properly, that they will get, shoot them?
They tell me that they're going to kill themselves, and they ask me, how do I use the gun? Am I allowed to show them how to use the gun?
Right. So fine. Let's just talk now about doctors. Let's talk about the person. Can a person do it? Kill themselves. Okay, that's the question.
The question is suicide?
Yeah. Physician-assisted suicide is now the people, they wouldn't have done it if it wasn't legal, but now they're doing it, right? What do we say to them? We had a patient at Cedars who, you know, part of the law is that you have to request it one day, and then you have to request it again 15 days later to show that you're really, it wasn't just like a one-time thing. So it became legal June 9th this year. We had a patient request it 15 days before it was legal. Why? He said he was told, no, it's not legal. He said, I know, but it's going to be legal in 15 days. I want the day it becomes legal. Yeah. So what do we do about that? We had a woman told me once that she was like, you know, I have a terminal illness. I probably have more than 6 months, but I'm exaggerating to my doctors. I've wanted to die for a long time. And so now this is my way. I'm going to do it, even though I'm not really.
That person asked on the day it was legal.
Well, no, he was told the first time. He's like, no, it starts June 9th. It doesn't start yet. Yeah. So it's a big deal. I'm feeling like I'm not going to go into in depth. I have like notes here from a presentation I gave to on Cedars, but it would take me 10 minutes to get through it. I don't want to do it in a rush way. So let me just say clearly that this is a big issue. It's something that is profoundly, obviously forbidden. And the response should be, you know, we need to be advocating for better end-of-life care, for better palliative care and pain management, so that people don't need to make such a horrible decision. Of course, when we meet patients, and I meet them on a regular basis who have made this decision, the attitude is not to condemn them and to curse them and tell them how bad they are. In Oregon, the first state where it became legal, there's a lot of data. They've been researching it very closely. And they found out the number one reason why people do this. People usually think it's depression or pain. The number one reason people take the assisted dying medication is control. They want to have control of their dying process. And so I think there is even a way to argue halakhically. We would never defend this decision. When people ask me, there's no nuance. It's usur. It's forbidden. It's horrible. There is room, though, for showing a certain type of compassion. What do I mean? Remember last week we saw the tshuva of Shlomo Zalman, who said that sometimes you're allowed to pray for someone to die. You can actually pray for that someone die. But he said, even then, while you're praying for them to die, you have to be mechal al Shabbos to save their life. So, and we know, the Aruch HaShulchan says it's beferish, but we know that, and we've with Shaul HaMelech, that, you know, with suicide, we have this funny approach where we say, like, it's forbidden and it's horrible, but we're going to assume once you did it that you were an ones, that you were kind of a psychological distress, and we still will bury them in a Jewish cemetery, and we're still going to. So it is possible to show compassion to the person, even while we say we think what you're doing is wrong. We can't support this. And it's fascinating because there are studies in Oregon that have shown that the people who had their sense of desire for control respected, the majority of the time, they get the prescription, but they don't take it. And so if someone is going to come with an approach of like, okay, I need to tell you how horrible this is. We don't tell them it's allowed. We tell them we're not for this, but we help them feel a sense of control. Like, here's what the dying process is going to be like. Tell me more about what you're going through. Let me understand what you're feeling, and help them feel like they're that they are the ones who are making this decision on their own, and oftentimes through that they don't do it. People think it's depression. We once had a patient who was dying, a 30-year-old woman who was dying. She had a 2-year-old child. She was horribly depressed. Finally, the doctors called the chaplain. They should have called this much earlier. They are putting on all types of depression medications. What did the depression medications do? More symptoms. It made it worse. Didn't help her. So we're talking to her, and she says, finally, we get to the bottom of it. Like, what is depressing you so much? It's not so easy to just say, oh, just because you're dying? She says, no, I have a 2-year-old daughter. My daughter's never going to know her mother. That's what's depressing me. So we talked about that. Well, you know what? There's something called an ethical will. What if you wrote down a document with all your values, everything you want her to know about you, and your beliefs, and your values, and your preferences, and what's important to you, and what your wishes are for her? And then we make a video of you. A video that you give to your, that will be your daughter's way of knowing who her mother was. You could talk to her about who you were and what you hoped for her. And she got so excited, and we did this. And her depression lifted. She didn't become happy-go-lucky. I mean, she was dying. In fact, she did die soon after that. But she had there was a sense of, like, of control and a sense of meaning, and that helped her. And sometimes we can work with patients without condemning them, but without saying that we agree with them. And it can help them to make a better decision. You know that in the Golden Gate Bridge is one of the most common suicide spots in America, that sometimes people survive the jump. And they've done studies on them. The most common thing people think while they're falling, they ask them this, the most common thing they think is regret. Which means horribly, it's so sad. People kill themselves, they regret doing it. It's not that they want to be dead, that they just want the pain to stop. And so we can work with people to try to find an alternative without condemning them, but by showing a compassionate, supportive approach, but without showing approval. It's very challenging. Rav Usher Weiss, when he last spoke at Cedars, we asked him the following question to deal with. A doctor is obligated to share the patient's options with them. I have to give you your options. A doctor has to give you the patient their options. But some of their options are forbidden. Your issue, right? Can I tell them an option? I'm not going to do it, but I'm giving them an option to do something that's usher. So Rav Usher said, not only is it not us forbidden to tell the person that this option, is you should tell them. What do you mean you should tell them? Why? He said, because someone's going to tell them. Better it be someone who agrees that it's problematic, ethically problematic, than have someone tell them who thinks it's, oh yeah, this is a great idea. You should tell them, and while you tell them, you can share with them why, you know, there may be other better choices as well. Anyways, that's the issue. I'll end there. We'll discuss questions. I don't feel bad for people who want to leave. But that's another big issue that's a big challenge. It's legal in America, but it's certainly forbidden by Jewish law. How do we deal with it? Let's discuss. Yeah, so... Right, good question. I mean, as a chaplain, so for example, I'll give you one more. People have to leave. I'll give you one more. So I asked Rav Usher Weiss the same question. Because... another issue that I have frequently that many people might have, so it might be relevant, is I get this following call almost every day. In fact, today I got this call. Rabbi, come, this patient is dying. They're intubated. They want to say a prayer before they die, so please come up and say the prayer, because once you get here, then we're going to intubate and let them die, So please come up so that the patient can die. So in other words, when you get here, they're going to die. So how am I going to go? I'm going to go so quickly, get here to kill. Like, am I killing the patient? So I asked a few rabbis. One rabbi I said... you really should not go. But I asked my boss about that. I was like, is there any way that I... He was like, yeah, you're going to have to quit your job. Like, this is your job. It's daily. So I asked another great rabbi. He said, when you show up, do they see you walking in there as Rabbi Weiner, post-lake Rabbi Weiner, or Rabbi Weiner, chaplain, pastoral care Rabbi Weiner? I said, chaplain. I'm a chaplain. I'm not post-lake. He said, exactly. He said, you're there for pastoral care. They're not asking if it's Asur or Mutter, okay? That's what he said. Rav Usher Weiss told me the following I found very profound. He said, again, not only can you go, you should go. Why? He told me a story. There's a paraplegic in his community, in remote, who's suffering a lot, and he's dying. He's very, very sick. And he's had a life of suffering. And he called Rav Usher Weiss to come to his house very urgently. He shows up, and he says, Rebbe, I've had it. I can't live like this anymore. My life is too difficult. He's being kept alive by a trach, by an air oxygen tube. He says, Rabbi, I'm going to pull it out. I can't live anymore. So I need a heter, though. I'm not going to do this without a heter from the Rav. So can I pull it out? In my case, I mean, I'm just suffering. It's a life of suffering. So Rav Usher Weiss said, I can't give you a heter for that. It's suicide. You can't do that. So he said, okay, Rabbi, I didn't think you would say it's allowed. So how about this? I'm going to do it anyways. So will you daven for my neshama? Will you pray for my soul? At least let my soul not go to Gehenna. Because you know how much I've suffered. At least pray for me. So Rav Asher says, he trapped me. If you think about it, he trapped me. Okay, now I'm going to tell him, yes, I'll pray for your soul. And he was going to say, okay, good. The rabbi at least gave me that. A little bit of a hetzer. He said he's going to pray for me, so it's fine. So he says, I had to think quick. What do I tell him? If I say, no, I'm not going to pray for you, how can I say that to him? He said, this poor guy, he's suffering. And he says, he's under duress. He's stressed. Who knows what he's going to do? If I say no, he's going to say, you rabbis, you don't get me. I'm doing it anyways. So he said, I decided, you know what? I need to show him love. I need to show him compassion. So I said to him, I really hope you don't do it. Of course, I will always daven for you. I will always remember you and I will always daven for you. He said, it's been 5 years now since that story happened. He has not done it. He said, so too. Go there. Be with them. Don't condemn them. But you're a rabbi, and they might say to you something like, is this okay, rabbi? You know, or they might think twice, or there might one in a thousand times, they might actually say, should I not do this? Or, you know, it happens all the time. I'm there with them, they do it, and then they say, okay, rabbi, now we need burial advice. We're going to do cremation. Can you give us a number for Jewish cremation? That is a question I get all the time. So my response to that is, well, tell me why you're choosing cremation. And very often the answer is, well, it's cheaper, we don't have a lot of money. So I say, oh, you know what, if you want, I'll arrange the whole thing for you. I can arrange the whole burial for you for cheaper than cremation. Would you like me to take care of that for you? I say, oh, if it's cheaper, okay, let's do that. Okay, fine. So you know what, we accomplished something. They extubated because I got there, but then at least we prevented a cremation. So that's what he said, you should go. So it's complicated. It's a very big challenge. The Nishros Avram has a whole arichos if you could do an abortion, if an anesthesiologist can participate in an abortion. Like, you know, that's even one step removed. It's very, very complicated, these issues, but that's how we navigate them. Yeah.
I have two questions. One might be sort of a silly question.
They both may be this one.
So, when you're getting, if someone's getting organs, in effect, I mean, they're taking, it could be a Jew that is brain dead, they're taking organs from. Is there any issue with that? I mean, the fact that you're
Yeah, so that depends who you ask. Some people say, no, you're causing the death of someone else to give you an organ. Though, if it didn't go to you, there's such a long list of needs for organ donation that it would have gone to someone else. And there's a lot of different ways to deal with it. Some poskim say, you know what, they didn't die based on the halakha criteria, but at least if they died, if they're not Jewish, and they died based on the accepted criteria of that country, that might be enough. But some would say, no, you can't take it. But, yeah. Right.
I know that abortion, if the woman's going to die, you can see a baby erode. Is there any state of a full human being where we consider them somewhat subhuman? Like, is there anywhere, are there any places where you say that there is a state where we don't consider somebody human?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's a very complicated issue with a trefa. You know, if you kill someone who's a trefa, who has an injury that they will die within a year from certain organs, so technically killing them is usser. But it's not misas based in, it's misa b'dei shemayim, you don't have the same level of culpability for killing a trefa. But for practical purposes, in America today, we do not distinguish and we do not say that anyone has less of a life. There is, like we talked about last week a little bit, chaye shah versus chaye olam. If someone is terminal, we have a concept in the Gemara, chaye shah lo chashinan. You're allowed to take certain risks in a chaye shah, someone who's terminal, that you might not be allowed to take if someone has a extended, it has a full lifespan left to live. There are some times when things vary, but generally speaking, we do not categorize. With triage, there's lots of issues. Who you save, you can save someone who has a better chance of surviving before someone else. We do have triage, halacha. So there is a little bit complicated, but for the most part, we treat all life as equal.
For end of life, are the doctors allowed to prescribe the medication?
Yeah, it's illegal. Oh, from doctor?
Yeah.
I don't think so. No.
No,
I don't think a firm doctor could prescribe the aid in dying medication. It's really misayeh. I mean, you're telling them how to do it, when to do it, the firm doctor could not prescribe it. They would have to excuse themselves from it. They could talk about it. That was what Rav Asher Weiss said. They could have the discussion with the patient, and then if they say they do it, they have to excuse themselves. Yeah, let's stop there.